Let's see. Bhagavatam, Canto 5, which is entitled The Creative Impetus. And we're on chapter number 14, The Forest of Enjoyment. And today we're on text number 16, which is a prose verse, so we'll just go through the word for word. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Translation. Government men are always like carnivorous demons called rakshasas, man-eaters. Sometimes these government men turn against the conditioned soul and take away all his accumulated wealth. Being bereft of his life's reserved wealth, the conditioned soul loses all enthusiasm. Indeed, it is though he loses his life. Please repeat. Government men are always like carnivorous demons. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The word Rajakula Rakshasa is very significant. Srimad Bhagavatam was compiled about 5,000 years ago, yet government men are referred to as Rakshasas or carnivorous demons. If government men are opposed to a person, that person will be bereft of all his riches, which he has accumulated with great care over a long period of time. Actually, no one wants to pay income taxes. Even the government men themselves try to avoid these taxes. But at unfavorable times, income taxes are exacted forcibly, and the taxpayers become very morose. I don't have a lot of experience with government tax collectors, unfortunately, to draw upon for this class. I thought I would read a few accounts from the Shastra about government men taking money from people, and one account from the Diary of a Traveling Preacher by Indrajit Maswami. First of all, of course, our business is to hear and chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, which are composed of different names of Radha and Krishna with the hope of awakening our dormant love for Radha and Krishna. So, however, we have a verse talking about government men ripping people off. So, how is this? So, Indrajit Swami would say that half of Srila Prabhupada's purports deal with telling how wonderful the spiritual world is and attracting us to want to go there. And the other half talk about how miserable the material world is and to give us impetus to get out of here. So that is, today's verse is one of those type verses. So the first account I wanted to talk about is the account of Ramachandra Khan. So for students of Chaitanya Charitamrita, this person is very famous as the person who tried to cause Haridas Thakur to fall down by sending a professional prostitute to tempt him. And of course, that was a great offense, and he was actually punished very severely for this offense. And so Ramachandra Khan's business was questionable, for he tried to avoid paying income tax to the government. Therefore, the government minister of finance was angry and came to his residence. The Muslim minister made his residence in the Durga Mandapa of Ramachandra Khan and killed a cow and cooked the meat at that very place. It turns out after he offended Haridas Thakur, Lord Nityananda came there and he offended him as well. So Lord Nityananda cursed him that his Durga Mandapa wasn't fit for him. In fact, it was only fit for Muslim meat eaters. And as a result of that curse, this Muslim meat eater came and killed a cow in his Durga Mandapa and ate the meat there. The Muslim minister then arrested Ramachandra Khan along with his wife and sons And he continuously plundered the house and village for 3 days. In that very room, he cooked the flesh of the cow for 3 consecutive days. Then the next day, he left, accompanied by his followers. The Muslim minister took away Ramachandra Khan's position, wealth, and followers. And for many days, the village remained deserted. So the government has a right to take some tax, according to the Vedic system. Basically, the Kshatriyas, they would live by exacting taxes from the citizens, but they had to provide some service. They would protect the citizens. And Kshatriya means, comes from two words, Kshat and Triyate. Kshat means hurt, and Triyate means deliver. So the Kshatriyas were supposed to protect the citizens, and in reciprocation, they could take, the government could take 1/4 of the accumulated wealth. It wasn't that there were special loopholes how the rich people could get away without paying anything, or a certain system where some people paid more than others. Everyone, they paid 1/4 to the government, and that was that. So here, minister, he didn't just take away 1/4 of Ramachandra Khan's property. He took away all of his property. And he didn't just punish him, but it says that he continuously plundered the house and the village for 3 days. Of course, this was a reaction to offending Haridas Thakur and Lord Nityananda, but still, the Muslim government man was very enthusiastic to do this. It wasn't like it was difficult for him, because that's the nature in this age that's described in the 12th canto, in the Bhumi Gita, which is chapter 3. All the anomalies of the age of Kali are enumerated in great detail, and that the government officials will become just like rakshasas and torture the conditioned souls by taxation is described there. So in this case, this Ramachandra Khan, he was certainly deserving of being harassed by the government. But the other cases, the people are more innocent. There's another story about government taxation, and also in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, and this deals with the father and uncle of Raghunath Das Goswami. So the deal with these people is that they were very, very rich. Actually, it's described that all the brahmanas in Bengal practically subsisted on the charity given by these two brothers, Govardhan and what was the other guy's name? Hiranya. Hiranya and Govardhan Majumdar. And let's say, so basically, these two brothers, their business was to collect taxes on behalf of the government. And because of this, they got themselves into trouble. And unfortunately, even Raghunath Das Goswami got in trouble because of their association. So I'll read that pastime. We can talk about some of the details. Actually, the best way to relate these pastimes is to tell them from memory, like Raghunath Maharaj does, but I'm not so expert, so I'm going to read it. But it's a lot more, makes the class flow better if people can just like eloquently speak the thing from memory. At the time, there was a Muslim official collecting the taxes of Saptagram. When Hiranya Das, Raghunath Das's uncle, made an agreement with the government to collect taxes, the Muslim Chaudhary, or tax collector, having lost his position, became extremely envious of him. Hiranya was collecting 2 million coins and therefore should have delivered 1.5 million to the government. Instead, he was giving only 1.2 million and thus making an extra profit of 300,000 coins. So these people are very upstanding individuals. They're described by Lord Chaitanya as almost Vaishnava. They were so charitable to the Vaishnavas. They supported Haridas Thakur. Their son was Raghunath Das. So they're very they were practically Vaishnavas, but because they had a tendency for material enjoyment, Lord Chaitanya refers to them as being almost Vaishnavas, because we know from Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu that devotional service should be anyabhilashita shunyam gyanam karmadyanavritam, that real devotional service isn't mixed with the desire for material gain. But these people actually wanted material gain so much that instead of giving the whole 1.5 million to the government, they only gave 1.2 million and they collected an extra 300,000 gold coins. As it's said here by Prabhupada in the purport, even government men themselves try to avoid these taxes. Every day, okay, let's see. After sending a confidential account to the government treasury, the Chaudhary brought the minister in charge. The Chaudhary came wanting to arrest Hiranyadas, but Hiranyadas had left home. Therefore, the Chaudhary arrested Raghunath Das. So, when we associate with materialistic people, unfortunately, we can become implicated in their material life, as happened with Raghunath Das. He was an innocent person who just wanted to chant Hare Krishna and follow Lord Chaitanya, but because of his relatives, he got hauled off to jail. Every day, the Muslim would chastise Raghunath Das and tell him, "Bring your father and elder brother, otherwise you'll be punished." The Chaudhary wanted to beat him, but as soon as he saw Raghunath's face, his mind changed, and he could not beat him. Instead, the Chaudhary was afraid of Raghunath Das because Raghunath Das belonged to the Kayasta community. Although the Chaudhary would chastise him with oral vibrations, he was afraid to beat him. While this was going on, Raghunath Das thought of a tricky method of escape. Thus, he humbly submitted this plea at the feet of the Muslim Chaudhary. "My dear sir, my father and his elder brother are your brothers. All brothers fight about something. Sometimes brothers fight among themselves, and sometimes they have very friendly dealings. There's no certainty when such changes will take place. Thus, I am sure that although today you are fighting, tomorrow you three brothers will be sitting together in peace. Just as I am my father's son, so I am also yours. I am your dependent, and you are my maintainer. For a maintainer to punish the person he maintains is not good. You are expert in all the scriptures. Indeed, you are like a living saint." When the Muslim heard Raghunath Das's appealing voice, his heart softened. He began to cry, and tears glided down his beard. The Muslim Chaudhary told Raghunath Das, "You are my son from today on. Today, by some means, I shall have you released." After informing the minister, the Chaudhary released Raghunath Das and then began to speak with great affection. "Your father's elder brother is less intelligent. He enjoys 8,000 coins. But since I'm also a shareholder, he should give some portion of it to me. Now you go arrange a meeting between me and your uncle. Let him do whatever he thinks best. I shall completely depend on his decision." Raghunath Das thus arranged a meeting between his uncle and the Chaudhary. The matter was settled and everything was peaceful. So the idea was, first of all, the Chaudhary tried to get Raghunath Das, his father and uncle, in trouble with the government. But when Raghunath Das preached to him, he decided on a better strategy. Better that we not arrest them, but better that I get some share of the extra money that they're making. Right? So in the beginning, he was sounding like he was supporting the government, trying to arrest these guys. And later, when he realized actually it was better to rip off the government in a conspiracy, he changed and engaged Raghunath Das in working out an agreement where he got some of the 800,000 gold coins. So this is another example of cheating. Government men actually trying to cheat the government. So in this case, in the first case, the person being cheated was completely in the mode of ignorance. So offensive, he was trying to cause Haridas Thakur to fall down. In this next instance, the people were more pious. They actually supported all the Brahmanas in Bengal. They gave They gave facility to Haridas Thakur, etc. And this last case is a case of a great preacher of Krishna consciousness, Indradyumna Swami, who's trying to represent Lord Chaitanya in this world by spreading the holy name, and now he was cheated. This is from his diary, volume 5, chapter 10. When we arrived at the airport, I was one of the last persons to check in for the flight to Warsaw, Poland. After getting my boarding pass, this is in Ukraine, by the way, I changed the local currency I had received during my visit. It came to $200. I carefully put it in my pouch. This is 2 months' salary in this country, I thought, shaking my head. As I was late, I proceeded straight to customs and passport control. In Ukraine, one has to fill out a form declaring how much money one is carrying, both upon entering and leaving the country. As I had no money coming into the country, I filled out the departure form and declared $200. I was in no anxiety. Customs officials are only concerned about large sums of money going out. Little did I know how greedy they would be for my disciples' offerings of love. "Show me your money," barked the customs official in English. "I have only $200, I replied. "Show me," he said louder. I could tell something was up. I pulled out the $200 and showed it to him from a careful distance. He looked to make sure no one was watching. "You must give me $100 customs tax," he said. I knew from years of traveling in and out of Ukraine that there was no customs tax for travelers, so I put the money back in my pouch. "Quickly," he said, looking around him. "Sir," I said, "you know as well as I do that there's no such thing as customs tax for something carrying this amount of money." "Give it now, or I won't let you any further," he said impatiently. I could see he was determined, but so was I. I wasn't about to hand over the money I'd received with love from the little boy and girl, the old woman, and the devotees I'd left at the temple. No way. The customs official grabbed my passport and put it in the drawer in front of him and locked the drawer. He was smiling with confidence. "You're going to miss your flight unless you give me the tax," he said. Angry at his audacity, I leaned over the counter. "Go to hell," I said. It may not have been the most tactful thing to do. He picked up the phone and called several other customs officers over. As they talked off to the side, it was obvious that they were all in on the effort, and for me to appeal to a higher authority would be useless. Another customs official, apparently of higher rank, came around the counter. "Come with me," he said, and he led me to a nearby office. With the rest, Shri Shri Radha Gopinath Ki, Shri Shri Gaurani Thai Ki, Shri Gopal Ki. "Come with me," he said, and led me to nearby office. With the rest of the officials behind him, he turned on the computer and made a show of looking for something. "Ah," he said, "Mr. Tibbetts, you've had some trouble in this country before, isn't it?" "What do you mean?" I replied. "Some criminal activity," he said with a little grin. I knew what he was up to. "Shall we blacklist you?" One of the customs officials, younger than the rest, looked at me from the back and shook his head from side to side. He was giving me a silent message. "Don't do this. Don't fight with them." I hesitated for a moment. These criminals were stealing Krishna's money. But if I didn't give in, my disciples and I would suffer a worse fate. I wouldn't be able to visit Ukraine again. I decided that discretion was the better part of valor. I slowly slid a $100 bill across the table. The customs officer slid my passport across the table. I gathered my things, stood up, and walked toward the door. As I walked out, an official standing there put out his foot, and I tripped and fell to the ground. Because I had not closed my handbag properly, everything spilled out onto the floor. Without looking back at the customs officials, who I imagined were getting a good laugh, I collected my things on my hands and knees, and then stood up and left. So later on, he says that that was an arrangement by Krishna for him to become more humble. So this shows how actually there's a lot of cheating going on in the government. These people had no right to collect any tax, but they cruelly, most viciously harassed this person who was just trying to benefit people by giving them Krishna consciousness. And these people in Ukraine, they practically have no money. They gave whatever little money they had to Indradumna Swami for their spiritual benefit, and these rascals took it just for their own sense gratification. So this nonsense stuff is going on even more in Kali Yuga than in the other ages. And this whole chapter, The Forest of Enjoyment, is trying to convince us that although we have, by the arrangement of the mode of passion, we have so many ideas for how we can be happy in this material world, it's a great illusion to think there is real happiness in this world. Whatever happiness is here is always mixed with some distress. Even the big, big demigods like Indra, they also have to worry about the demons coming and taking over. Either there's Bali Maharaj or Hiranyakashipu, somebody who's always trying to take over the planet of heaven. Prithu Maharaj was performing horse sacrifices, and Indra was so afraid that his position would be taken, he went to the trouble of stealing the horse for the sacrifice. So even if we, by our pious devotional service, make it to the heavenly planets because we still have material desires, still there, even there we will be harassed. There's no place of peace and satisfaction in this material world. One time I asked my spiritual master, Satsrupa Das Goswami, if there was any verses I could read to become more inspired to be a brahmachari. And he suggested, you should read this chapter, The Forest of Enjoyment. So it's true. It shows how that all our different attempts for happiness in this material world are ultimately going to fail. So, and it's important to hear these things because if we practice devotional service and at the same time we maintain material desire, the best we can do is we can become demigods. Basically, the demigods, they're called Sakama devotees. They have some desire to serve Krishna, worship Krishna. In fact, they have very important positions in the universal affairs. But because they're they have a lot of faith that material enjoyment is actually real. They're stuck in this material world. It's described when the creation takes place, all these demigods, they again take birth because of their material desires. They take birth in this world. And so we're followers of Lord Chaitanya and the six Goswamis, and we're practicing pure devotional service free from material desire, because we don't want to be stuck in this place where, in fact, in these accounts I was reading, one account, Raghunath Das is thrown in jail just because his relatives didn't pay all their income tax. And then this other account, Indradumna Swami has to forfeit $100 that's supposed to be used in devotional service because these rascals invent some imaginary tax and take it away. So even if you're a pure devotee and your only ambition is to become Krishna conscious and give Krishna conscious, still you get implicated in this nonsense taxation and harassment by government men. And so this isn't a place that we want to stay. It's not a fun place. Sometimes we look at too many advertisements or we look at too many people enjoying and we become enamored. And therefore we always have to read these accounts in the Srimad Bhagavatam so we know what the actual story is. It's described Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. Every day we have to read the Bhagavatam. My spiritual master, Satsrupa Das Goswami, he wrote a book called Reading Reform Notebook one time, where he went through all of Prabhupada's instructions about the importance of reading. And he sort of summarized them by saying that Prabhupada wanted us to go to Bhagavatam class every morning, and he also wanted us to have some evening class. Actually, in all our centers, we're supposed to have some evening program with a kirtan and a class. And in addition to that, we should read his books at least an hour every day. So if we do this, then we'll hear all the bad things about the material world and all the good things about the spiritual world, and we'll be motivated to be steady on our devotional practice. So that's about the limit of the notes I've taken. Usually I have more notes than I have time. It's rare that I have more time than I have notes. But my favorite service in Krishna consciousness, except for Harinam, is to answer questions about Krishna consciousness. When I go on Indradyumna Swami's Polish festival every year, I spend an hour in the question and answer booth, and I work for the BBT website known as Krishna.com, answering questions about Krishna consciousness. So, of course, you've got much better people here to answer questions about Krishna consciousness than me. You have Radhanath Swami, and you have all these senior people who have actually taken the Bhakti Shastri course and are teaching it. But if anyone has any questions about this verse or devotional service in general or anything, I'll be glad to answer them at this time. I'll read the verse again, just because we often do that at the end of classes. And government men are always like carnivorous demons called rakshasas or meat eaters. Sometimes these government men turn against the conditioned soul and take away all his accumulated wealth. Being bereft of his life's reserved wealth, the conditioned soul loses all enthusiasm. Indeed, it is though he loses his life. Does anyone have any questions or comments or realizations they'd like to share with people today?
Thank you for a nice class. Devotees here would like to know something about your work with Sadaput Prabhu and what kind of preaching activities you have been doing with him and what is his latest service in the preaching field.
Aha. Well, Sadaput Prabhu has been one of the members of Bhaktivedanta Institute since it was founded by Srila Prabhupada in 1975. And there have been different philosophies about what Bhaktivedanta Institute should be doing. Basically, Sadaput always felt that he should be writing books that challenge the very theories of the modern materialistic scientists, which are all very atheistic theories. We know Srila Prabhupada made many, many, many comments about the scientists and how they were cheating the public. And he wanted his scientific disciples to kick on Darwin's face, so to speak. So there are other people in the Bhaktivedanta Institute who wanted to organize seminars and make friends with the scientists and give them Krishna prasadam and deal with them in a more like socially acceptable way like that. And they did that. And Sadaput and Drudha Karma wrote books challenging their ideas and their philosophy in great detail. Actually, I think their major work was that book, Forbidden Archaeology. And that was a truly awesome project. The book is 960 pages. It has 141 illustrations. And it weighs 4 pounds and costs $45. And it talks about hundreds of pieces of evidence that are too old for the theory of evolution. And if one of those pieces of evidence is true, any one of the several hundred they mention, then the whole theory is wrong and shouldn't be taught in the schools and should be thrown out altogether. And the reason the book is so long is they wanted to go back to the original source material, the original reports by the scientists, and show that they had really done their homework. They weren't just a few fanatics trying to propagate some religious idea and they were just out to criticize them, but they actually had a lot of proof that these finds were legitimate and that it was actually duplicitous of the scientists to ignore them. Before I went to work with Sataputta, I thought, in the spiritual sense, you can say the scientists are cheaters because there is God and they're trying to explain things without God. So in that sense, but even by the common man's definition of cheater or the dictionary definition of cheater, these scientists are cheaters. Because according to their scientific method, if a piece of evidence disagrees with the theory, they're supposed to broaden the theory so that the theory accommodates the evidence. But these people, they were so attached to their theory of evolution, they would discredit the evidence, the methodology by which the evidence was attained. They would assault the character of the people who found the evidence. And so they weren't even following their own scientific method. Basically, they're a bunch of fools and rascals who, Sataputta once said, they believe in their theories just as much as any Baptist believes in Lord Jesus Christ. You know, scientists are always trying to say that their process is objective, it's rational, it's like that, and the religionists are just a bunch of people with blind faith. You know, but actually, if you look at the evidence, the scientists are people with blind faith. So their faith is so blind that when they get a piece of evidence that disagrees with their theory, instead of changing the theory to accommodate the evidence, they discredit the evidence to preserve their theory. So that's pure blind faith by anyone's definition. So he wrote that book, and then he wrote a very controversial book, Alien Identities. That book was very controversial because, of course, the scientific establishment doesn't accept UFOs. So if we write a book that's supportive of UFOs, it makes us look bad in the eyes of the scientists. But the reason he wrote that book, which people should know, is that actually the modern UFO phenomena gives a lot of empirical evidence for the reality of a lot of Vimanas and a lot of human-like entities that are described in the Vedic literatures. In the Ramayana, in the Mahabharata, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, there are innumerable counts of flying machines and human-like beings that pilot these machines that have mystical powers that are very similar to the powers of the UFO entities. So actually, what he wrote was really what he called a study of comparative folklore that shows how that there's a similarity in these accounts. And therefore, and these accounts themselves, a lot of them are very credible, these UFO accounts, because what they'll do is they'll have different people who witness the thing. They'll interview them separately, and they'll all report the same experience. If it was something fabricated, if they interviewed different people, then they would all have a different story. You know, one person would say this, one person would say another. But if they had different people who weren't collaborating in any way, who witnessed the same thing, and they would come up with the same story. Yeah. And so, basically, he found that it was very amazing that there's all the in these modern UFO accounts, there's a lot of evidence for like human-like forms. We describe there's 400,000 human-like beings, and we also have all these vimanas. We have Shalva's vimana, right, in the Krishna book, and we have Kardama Muni's vimana, his flying city. So, and they have many of the same properties that the vimanas in the Vedic literature and the modern UFOs. They have similar qualities. So that was another book. Then recently he wrote the cosmology book. So the cosmology book, the important thing about that's another controversial book, of course. And Dhanavir Maharaj thinks that Sataputta was too liberal in interpreting the cosmology of the Bhagavatam. But what he does do in that in his analysis of the Bhagavatam is he shows that there was real astronomy going on in India 5,000 years ago, which is something the scholars don't actually think. The scholars think that Indian astronomy was actually imported from the Greeks. Basically, the whole, as you probably know, being in India, the scholars think that actually that Western civilization is more advanced than Indian civilization, and any advancement in India must have come from the West. You know, like it must have come from the Greeks. You know, that these Indians couldn't possibly have got it together to do any astronomy. If there's any astronomy in India, it came from the Babylonians or the Greeks. So this shows actually that his analysis of the orbits of the planets corresponding to the boundaries of the dwipas and oceans of Bhumandala showed that there was actual knowledge of the solar system dating back 5,000 years in India, which is very powerful, and it gives credence to the reality of the Vedic literature. This isn't just mythology. If it was mythology, it wouldn't bear any resemblance to physical reality. And so that's a great contribution, actually. And then he wrote this book, Maya, which is basically the idea of virtual reality is very popular now. I don't know, are people in India familiar with the movie called The Matrix? Is that something people... Did that make it to Bombay? Yeah. And so... basically, our situation in this world actually is like that of a person hooked up to a virtual reality. Because as we know, we're pure souls, part and parcel of Krishna. We have absolutely nothing to do with the material world. We have never had anything to do with the material world, and we never will have anything to do with the material world. But the false ego energy of the Supreme Lord causes us to identify ourselves with a particular body, with particular senses, and therefore we think we are in the material world, we're moving through the material world, we're part of the material world is our home. So he develops this idea that you can't actually make a physical explanation of consciousness. You can't, basically, the scientists are saying that this body is just like a machine. Our brain is just like a computer. So if our brain is just like a computer, why is there consciousness in our brain? We don't find consciousness in our computer, right? Your Pentium Pro or whatever it is doesn't show any symptoms of consciousness, right? It doesn't feel pain when you bang on it because it's too slow or whatever, or it lost your files or something. It doesn't have desire, right? These things aren't associated with computers. So if the brain is just a complicated computer, where does the consciousness of the brain come from? What is it in the pattern of molecules in the brain that cause it to be aware? Right? Actually, there's no reason to think there'd be any consciousness in the brain if it's just a bunch of chemicals. That's another item of the blind faith of the scientists. So, but this idea that our consciousness comes from another source and is projected into this body can actually explain things that can't be explained otherwise. And his most recent book was called God and Science, which I personally think might be of some utility for your preaching here, because it's a collection of BTG articles on five different topics. One is evolution, one is consciousness, one is physics, one is civilization and cosmology, and the other is science and religion. And there's 21 different articles. 20 of them were originally written for BTG, and one is from the... those series of conferences organized by Bhakti Srup Damodar Maharaj. One was a paper that he wrote for that conference. So some of his people complain that Sadaputta's books are too technical, but these BTG articles, because they're re-edited by the editors for BTG, are a lot easier to read. And because they're organized by different topics, they're easy for people to relate to. Because they can just choose the topics that they're interested in and read a few articles about that. And the whole reason we put the book together is a very nice Swami you may not be familiar with, because he's a very low-profile Swami, but he's been doing a lot of valuable preaching in the U.S. for many years. His name is Ganapati Swami. He has a program of traveling through, 20, 25 colleges every year in the U.S. from as far north as, like, Illinois and Indiana down to like Arizona. He just travels the whole year setting up book tables of Prabhupada's books and Sadaputta's books and other books of prominent devotee writers he thinks would be of interest to the students. And he sells many, many books that way. And he thought that the students could much better appreciate this collection of articles rather than Sadaputta's books because they're a little too technical. So we produced this book called God and Science, and I have one copy that I lent somebody, but if you're interested in looking at it, you can borrow it from me. But it could be something that's useful for your preaching, especially here you have a lot of people who are pious Hindus who are scientists, you know, so the atheistic theories aren't so overwhelming for them. But there are a few, I imagine there are a few students who are a little bit enamored with these theories, although many of them aren't so much as they are in the West. And this book would be useful for those people. As for what he's doing right now, I wrote him just a couple weeks ago, and he said that he's doing he's doing radio shows, and he's giving lectures at the University of Florida, which is he's based in Gainesville these days. And I don't know that he's writing any other books. At one time, he went to South India with Atmatattva Prabhu and did a lot of research of regarding psychic phenomena, different things that were evidences for things that are beyond the laws of nature, basically. And he was contemplating writing a popular book that showed there's more to material nature than our present physical laws are letting us know. And I did some research on that, but I don't know if he's actually going to publish it. But we also have... he did six different videos on different topics like evolution. He has a very beautiful one called Models of Natural Selection, where he takes what's called a bacteriophage, which some of you scientists may know about. It's a small virus that eats bacteria. And he makes a 3D graphics computer model of this, how this thing is built and how this thing operates. And then he says, what would it take to make this virus so that it could eat bacteria with a little bigger cell wall? Well, you'd have to make this part of it longer, you'd have to make this part of it wider, you'd have to do this. What are the odds that this mutation to make it longer and this mutation to make it wider and this mutation to do this and this mutation to do that would all happen at once such that the thing could actually evolve to just be a little bit bigger than it is? And he calculated it all out, and it's 1 × 10⁴ power. One times 10 to the negative 84th power. You know, one with 84 zeros after it. Like it would never happen. Not in a million years, a billion years, a quadrillion years. even in Lord Brahma's lifetime of 311 trillion years, it wouldn't happen. So, and it's a very powerful. It's for people who are really into science. Like some of these med students who study biology, they could get into it, you know. And he challenges the scientists. You say your theory of evolution is true. Use your big computers to make actual models. Your technology is so advanced now, you can make models of these things, and you show with your models how they would evolve, you know. And his challenge is that if they did that, they would actually show that their theory actually doesn't make a bit of sense. You know? So, and that's one of them. He has another one on called Mind and Brain, which deals with how you can't explain consciousness in mechanistic terms. And he has one called Models of Natural, one called Simulated Worlds, which deals with the idea that this world's like a virtual reality, and then he has some dealing with the universe like that. So those are interesting materials you might be able to utilize in your preaching, and I'm willing to show any of those videos and discuss them if anybody wants to do it. I'll probably leave around the 15th or the 12th to go to Vrindavan for Kartik, but I'll be here for like a couple weeks. Anything else or no? Thank you for your time, and enjoy your Ekadashi Vrata, and His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki.